Hi, everyone, and welcome to Palestine Exists, a space where we deep dive into all things Palestine, from history and politics to culture, resistance, and the stories that deserve to be told. If you've ever felt overwhelmed by headlines, frustrated by misinformation, or just eager to learn more about Palestine beyond the mainstream narrative, this is the place for you. As always, we have Hiba and Lina with us. Hey, guys, how are y'all?
Hi, baby girl. I'm
Hi, how are
fine.
you?
Hi, everyone. Sorry. No, us all speaking at the same
My
time.
gosh, just because we're all in sync, I mean, what can we say?
I
We're just all here. I mean, I'm good.
love that for us.
I feel like bloated after a thawed, but that's about it.
Oh my God.
Saha,
Albeek. But yeah, I guess today's like topic is it's a pretty interesting one. As always, I mean, I don't think we ever do uninteresting topics, but this one is specifically about the Christian population in Palestine and how Israel essentially uses them in order to like pitch a narrative about the Palestinian Muslims specifically and Palestinians as a whole and like our history as a whole. So basically, we know that Israel for a very long time has attempted to frame the decline of the Christian population in Palestine, specifically in Jerusalem in the West Bank, as of recently, to be caused by Muslim persecution. When in reality, we all know it's due to the same reason all Palestinian decline in the land, and it's due to the Israeli occupation and settler colonialism. But, it's interesting why they choose to, I don't know, paint this narrative. We could talk about why they try to paint this narrative, right? It's sort of this thing where it tries to create a sectarian divide between the Muslims and the Christians and tries to weaken Palestinian unity, which historically, like when we read into like people writing about Palestine and the unity that existed like hundreds of years ago, they spoke about these unities that existed where they when they reflected on Jerusalem and how there was quarters like the Christian quarters and the Muslim quarters and the Jewish quarters all living side by side. It's something that didn't really exist, but it's like something more recent with Israel's occupation and settler colonialism. So yeah, that's basically what we'll be talking about today. So stay
And a little
tuned.
bit, we'll also talk a little bit too about like the just the Palestinian Christians, what they like their theology, what they've a little bit about them, their role in resistance as well, because they're often overlooked or sometimes just like tokenized, like we use like George Habash or like Sekakini, right? Like they're like the two or three people, and I think it's important to highlight other figures that because Palestinian resistance is also Christian, Palestinian Christian resistance, Palestinian Muslim resistance, Palestinian atheists. Shout out to our like Marxist Murtad. And it like I just think it's yeah, it's really important too.
Yeah, like highlighting the idea that it's all Palestinian resistance, which is basically what Israel's trying to like negate, like, oh, Palestinian Christians are different and that, it doesn't exist. Not in our movement, at
And
least.
I feel like that, speaking about Palestinian Christian resistance, I feel like that debunks, it's oh those damn Muslims, those crazy barbaric Muslims. It's always them and it's them because they hate the Jews and blah blah blah. No, Palestinians, whether they're Muslim or Christian, they are fighting for their sovereignty, they are fighting for human rights. And I feel like this would be the bridge, to discuss it and show people that no matter if you're a Christian or a Muslim or an atheist, hi Echo, we would all still fight for our land. So
Yeah,
yeah.
definitely. So like, okay, one of the first things that always comes to my mind whenever I think about like Christians specifically, is a it's these two Palestinian Christian villages that were depopulated after the Nakba. And I say after the Nakba because this was more so after they were supposedly Israeli citizens, right? These are supposed to be Israelis. They're supposed to, in this unitary in this democratic state of Israel, as they always call themselves, the only democracy in the Middle East, they should be given their equal rights. And this village, these villages are called Ikrit and Biram. And basically, in like 1948, you had the IDF come to this village and say, "Hey, we need to depopulate this area just for 2 weeks. 2 weeks, and then you guys can come back." you know, like everything will be good. Like just leave for 2 weeks. It has nothing to do with you being Palestinian. You just gotta, it's for our goals and protecting the country. And they were like, okay, they decided, they saw what happened after the Nakba. They were like, okay, you know what? It's best, let's try complying. So they complied. They all left. They left for 2 weeks. They came back after 2 weeks. And after these 2 weeks were over, they're like, okay, we're ready to come back. And the IDF was like, no, sorry. We can't let you guys come back. Sorry. But they're like, no, but you told us that we can come back. Like, what's going on? And then they were like, nope, you're not coming back. And so what did the villagers do? You know, they're like, okay, we're not going to be hostile. They can't be hostile. This is like, they're ruled by the IDF. This is 19, you know, between 1948 up until 1966, they were ruled under the martial law, which meant they were ruled by the IDF. So they decided to go to the courts, the Israeli courts. And surprisingly, the courts actually ruled in their favor, and they're like, there's no reason for you guys to like continue to deny them, you know, access to the village. You said that they can come back after 2 weeks, but at the end of the day, it's up to the IDF. So this is what the courts had ruled. They're like, it's up to the IDF to let you guys back in. And the IDF, of course, continued and said no. Now, in 1951, on Christmas Day, the IDF decided to completely demolish and explode every single thing inside that village on Christmas Day, which shows you like the sadistic part about it. It's like they could have done it any other day. They just chose to do it
Yeah.
on Christmas Day to a predominantly Christian village. Now the reason why I chose like this is always what comes to my mind is because it's like so sadistic. It's so religiously targeted to do it on Christmas Day. And essentially, it's been now, I guess, 57 years, and these people are still trying to go back to their villages, and Israel has not aided them and or supported them in their right to return to the land, even though it's been demolished. And so, yeah, it's always something that comes to my mind, and it always like irks me whenever I hear Israel try to tokenize the Christian community, considering they are like a minority of a minority. Until this day, they can't even. Like this one small supposedly is Israeli Christian community, if you will, they can't even help them receive their possessions back. But yeah, that's just like one part of it. This was 76 years ago, and it just gets worse for the Palestinian Christians, Palestinians as a whole, but Palestinian Christians as well, considering they are such a small minority.
Yeah, I mean, and speaking about this specific village, there's a winery that one of our friends speaks about a lot, and it's called the Ashkod Winery. Their family is actually based and or they were based, they're indigenous to that's a village. And unfortunately, because of all of this, they were exiled out of that village, and now they're living in Kfar Yassif. And they established a winery. And the founder of this winery, his name is Nemi Ashad or Ashkar, sorry. And
That was so
he
many of
specifically,
you.
I know, and I'm trying. He specifically talks about, so he's the second generation of the displaced community of the village. And he says, when I saw more and more vineyards being planted around Akrat, I felt as if I was pierced by iron nails. I believed that if I were to make the wine, it must come from its marvelous vineyard. I knew I could bring in grapes from many other places, but I found no salvation in doing so. Indeed, I believe that salvation is to be found in wholesome work in a beloved land, and Akrat is my beloved land precisely because it is my homeland. Everywhere else I feel an exile, but in Akrat I feel at home. And he goes on to talk about how the winery is just another step of his struggle and trying to fulfill it, because even though he is a fallahi, a farmer, and he's working on, you know, tending to his vineyards and creating this wine, it still feels like a piece of him is missing because it's not coming from his village. And you know, we can speak a bit more about it when we talk about like the economics of the Christians and the economic struggles, but Yeah, so this is another thing. Not only were they displaced from these specific villages, they aren't even able to tend to their land. You know, we again we always speak about how a majority of Palestinians, whether they're Muslim or Christian, were fallahin or farmers, and this is also another missing piece. Due to the occupation, due to the exile of Palestinians, and this one specifically is a Christian. But yeah.
Wow. Yeah, guys, like, shout out to this winery. If you drink wine, definitely check them out.
Yeah, if
I
you're
saw it in the
that.
LCBO. It's kind of funny. I think that's where Glitchy saw it too. He saw this, like, he saw the symbol and how it said Ikrit.
Isn't the LCBO Palestinian owned?
Oh my God, is it?
I think so.
It might be. No, I'm just kidding.
No,
I don't.
what's the other one? No, LCBO. What's the other one? Shoot. It's not the Oh my God, what's it called? It's like the place that we go, like it's like open 24 hours. So I forgot. Like, yeah, in Toronto, it's Palestinian owned, I believe. Yeah, his family were Palestinian immigrants who came to Canada in 66, which is pretty cool. That's why, like, when you go there, they have like
A lot of Arab
Palestinian owned,
food,
like, yeah, a lot of
yeah.
Arab food, as well as like Palestinian owned stuff, which is pretty cool. So if
Oh,
you're
we
in the
love
GT,
them.
if you're in the GTA, you know, head to Rabah.
Big freaking W Rubba. Yeah, I didn't even know that. That does make sense though. I feel like I've heard this before. It might have been from you. But yeah, big W
Probably.
Rubba. But yeah, like in the like and definitely like if you even if you don't like drink wine, like I urge you to look at their story. They have a section on Ashkar Winery where they talk about their story and everything that that village has been through. I think it's it's a pretty kind way because it doesn't even mention how it was freaking destroyed on Christmas Day specifically, but that is when it was destroyed. But yeah, like a very very like disheartening reality to this group that is constantly tokenized by Israel. Now, another thing that always comes to my mind whenever I think of Christians and how Israel, I don't even know if it goes along with the pink washing thing that they do, but where they try to like do again try to pretend that there is only sectarian attacks being done by Muslims, and they just forget that like in their foundation when they were first being made into a country, they made it a point to change the plus sign for a specific, and I always say this as a joke, like I don't like it's definitely
Yeah,
not
I
our
know
biggest
this. Yeah,
concern.
I genuinely, Lena, I remember when you first brought this up, I was like, there's no way, like, no effing way this is true.
Well, it is. That's the thing. It's actually true. And I bring it up as a joke because I know it's not our biggest concern. But it's like the idea that they went out of their way to change the plus sign in math because it resembles the Christian cross. And it's like little miniature things like this that the Israeli state has done. And yeah, like literally, if you go to their schools, they use an upside down like capital T. So a plus sign minus like the bottom part of the plus. Basically is how they use a plus sign, but it's not the biggest concern, but it's something that like it's kind of worth noting. So basically the whole reason why I wanted to bring up this topic is because recently online I've been hearing from a lot of Zionists and Zionist think tanks essentially trying to convey this idea that the reason why there's been a decline of the Christian community in Gaza and the decline of the Christian community in Bethlehem is all because of the Muslims and Hamas and all these like scary, scary things that they're doing. So I took it upon myself to like, because I'm confused, right? As a Palestinian, I'm confused. I'm like, is their plight really different from our plight? Like, are they being persecuted because they're Christian by other Muslims? Is that really the reason why they're leaving? So I took it upon myself to go and research into Bethlehem and like why the Christian population has gone down. And the reality is, it has gone down, or percentage-wise, but it's because of the Nakba and the overwhelming like majority of Muslim villages being forced to immigrate into Bethlehem, right?
However, because Jesus was
Maybe their
Palestinian.
political history.
I'm just gonna talk like briefly. I'll talk about like the Christian villages and like that like were either expelled or like not demolished, but like specifically like El Abun, or it's It's Ilabun. I don't know how to pronounce it. I hate when they write like English, like Arabic words in English.
Arabic words in English.
Mm-hmm. It's so frustrating. But like this one was an Arabic Christian village, Palestinian Christian village. And there was a massacre. The IDF had, it's like, what's it called? Executed 13 villagers, even though they hid in the church and lifted the white flag. Mm. And yeah, so until then, like they commemorate until today, right? They commemorate the anniversary of the massacre, both Muslims and Christians, but it was a Christian village and they were expelled to Lebanon. And then Fasuta, I believe, there were Muslims and Christians, but today this village is a Greek Catholic village. And they fled, you know, in 1948. And so there's this village as well. The Christian villagers fled to Lebanon here. And then there's Ma'ilia, I think. Two villagers were killed by the Haganah. Yes, but the village was occupied and then the villagers fled to Lebanon. But they were allowed to come back to the village of Ma'ilia because the Greek Catholic priest negotiated with the Haganah for their return. Mm-hmm. There's I don't know. Interesting, right? This is
I think I've heard about this. The Greek Catholic Church is a similar thing with
Yes.
Yeah, I think I know this. And then there's recently too.
Tarshisha, there's Rami.
Yeah.
Tarshisha. Al-Jish, which is Gush Khalav. But Muhar and then Bu'ana, Al-Raini, Yafia, Baisan. Or Bisan, Kafir Kana, Kafir Yasif, Sakhin, Dirhana, Turan, Iblin, Judaida al Makir, Shif al Amr, right? Like, this is just me listing ones that were not destroyed, but the ones that were destroyed, like like Lena talked about it, Ikrit, Al Birwe, Al Basa, Dir al Qasi, which was, you know, Christian people. There was a monastery in like a church there, and it was occupied by, you know, in the 30th of October 1948, and they expelled and literally like expelled and unalived a lot of people who were there. And there's Sahmata, Al-Mansura in Jerusalem. There's Al-Barij, Al-Jura. Look, there's so many, and I just think it's like important to talk about them. However, when we talk about resistance, right, we always like come to mind, like there's a couple people that come to mind. So there's like Khalil Sakakini as well as like George Habash. But like what people don't know is like Sakakini, he like founded the Philistine newspaper. We know this, right? You know the Philistine one, the one that we always like make our backgrounds or whatever.
The Christian-owned one.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And he also like was a well-known scholar. He joined the Arab Revolt in the 30s in Hejaz, where he composed the anthem of the Arab Revolution. And Sakakini frequently met with Hajj Amin al-Husseini, and this unity proved to be an essential goal of the Palestinian Christians throughout the mid-20th century. That it was, we were all for a free Palestine, including Muslims, including, you know, Christians. And yeah, go ahead. Sorry, we're gonna say something.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The the literal flag that they had, the Palestinians against the revolt against like the British and the Zios, was literally a black flag that had the cross and the crescent symbolizing both Christianity and Islam.
Right.
And so like when he was asked about Zionism and the various riots in the 1920s, and as well as the anti-British movements, Khalil Sakakini literally said, "The battle for Palestine is in full force. Victory is in the hands of God. If we live, we shall live with honor. If we die, we shall die with honor." Right? And I think that's beautiful. And on top of that, like, there's so many, like, resistance groups that... Sorry, just one second. Let me pull it up. Were started like post 1948, like immediately after. And so even like, for example, do you guys know how we were talking about? You guys were talking about the wine company, but like, did you guys know that in 2014, in what was it called? That wasn't, was that cast-led?
Operation
Cast-Led. Was it in 2014? I'm not sure. But the Gaza war, or the Gaza, you know, another massacre in 2014, Taibeh, which is the Palestinian Christian village, they canceled their Oktoberfest to show unity with Gaza.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is pretty cool. Like, you know what I mean? They would do that.
They do it, like, I'm sorry to the Muslims out there, but the Christians in the West Bank are usually more united with Gazans than the Muslims. Like, they canceled Christmas for 2 years in a row because of Gaza genocide this time around. Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
Yep, and, like, Bishop Ilya Khoury said, in 87, that Palestinians resist Israeli occupation, like, you know, various groups throughout Europe resisted Nazi onslaught, which mm-hmm. I think is really interesting. And then we have also, like, George Habash, who we know was the founder of the, you know, my favorite, like, faction of Palestinian resistance, which is the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. But I'm not a commie, but I just like the commie vibes, you know?
Right.
Anyway. But, yeah, so he was one of, like, many Palestinian Christians who played crucial, roles in various pro-Palestinian groups that used armed resistance to send their message. Another Palestinian Christian was Wadi Haddad, Nayef Hawatmeh, I think.
Nayef Hawatmeh.
Yep. Kamal Nasser, who was the closest of advisor to Arafat, who was assassinated in 1973. But George Habash was, like, obviously known as Al-Hakim. He gained support through his pan-Arabism ideology. And him,
which a lot,
like,
of Christians were actually really in favor of pan-Arabism.
Yes. Yes. And he was able to cross religious boundaries by using, like, nationalistic ideology mm-hmm. as a common bonding characteristic. So, like, he was quoted saying, "When my land was occupied, I had no time to think about religion." Right. And I think that is beautiful. And another like the co-founder of the Palestinian American Churches for Peace in 2000, I believe, what was this in 2000? I'm not sure when. 2015 said, "I don't blame Hamas for their history of attacks against Israel." Right. So you can see mm-hmm. this, like, you see this, such a beautiful, like, trend of, like, I'm trying to think of what words to say because words are hard, but like this like, I don't know, like, this beautiful trend of Palestinian Christians continuing to support Palestinian nationalism through any means, the same way that we have, like or Palestinians just in general, right? You have political figures such as, like, the mayor of Bethlehem in 1977 saying we cannot accept Israeli military presence, mm-hmm. and like I said, like, I think it's, like, really interesting to talk about that. And, like, for specifically, like, theological speaking, I'm not sure, like, we talked about this before a little bit, but, like, you guys know how, like, St. George is such an icon within Palestinian Christians. Yep. Literally. Mm-hmm. And so when you see, like, why, you look into why, right? And they look at, like, it's such a unique practice, right? But, specifically when it comes to St. George, let me just pull it up 1 second. But yeah, a lot of Palestinian Christians or Orthodox Christians, like, they look at St. George as a representation as the struggle for justice, freedom, and political reforms. They call him George of Lydd, the patron saint of Palestine. Wow. Because of, you know, where he was. You see, when you travel to Palestinian Christian communities, you see St. George nearly everywhere. There's churches dedicated to George, children named after him, icons of St. George spearing the dragon can be found in and above many Palestinian Christian homes. And so he obviously, like, the reason why this adoration of St. George exists is because he's a local saint, right? He's a geographical and historical relationship to Palestinians. So, like, in Lydd, right, there's a church holding his remains in Palestine, which is where his mother is, where his mother came from, the city of Lydd. And secondly is because, like, St. George's heroism in defeating the dragon and confronting, like, Emperor Diocletian? I don't know how to pronounce this.
But we give you all three possibilities, though.
Listen, yeah, listen, I tried. Him confronting this emperor made him a protector of the household, the sick and the persecuted, and especially for Palestinian Christians. And St. George is one of the most important and venerated saints in the Orthodox Church. And like his name is the Great Martyr. So you see why Palestinian Christians, especially Orthodox ones, they treat him with such this like adoration and respect.
Maybe even like resonate.
But not just Palestinian Christians. Like they all, like he's also adored by Palestinian Muslims. So they
Al-Khadr.
And like Palestinian Muslims, like, even baptize their children in the church, right? This is really funny to me, but yeah. And there's like this Palestinian theologian, or Palestinian, like, whatever he is, yeah, but his name's Lance Laird, and he like suggests using the term Palestinian religion to describe the shared practices that exist within Palestinian Christian and Islam, Christianity and Islam, to talk about how we share this, like, this such a unique and nuanced, like, shared, like, kind of like religion, kind of,
it was, or religious actually aspects. Talked about by like these European like researchers that would like hundreds of years ago, they would come in and they would like view Jerusalem and they would talk about exactly what Hiba's talking about. Like, this is a serious thing where it's like, wow, they are so unified.
And like, for example, right, in Shu Isma, what village was this? In Al-Khadr, right? Basically, when Israelis invaded the village in 67, they were defeated by St. George. St. George appeared and drove the soldiers away and even grabbed the governor by the throat. Like, this is like, you know what I mean? This is just like, or another one's in the village of Taibe, where they say they believe that, like, the St. George protects their churches from, like, destruction. And I just think it's, like, I don't know, beautiful that we see this grassroots theology that is, like, focused, so focused within the faith as well as, like, resisting Israeli oppression. I don't know. It's really, really pretty to me. So there's, like, that. If you guys want to jump in, you can.
Definitely. But I mean, this goes perfectly, like, with essentially our topic. It's, like, how, like, before Israel, you saw unity amongst these communities, even the minority communities, and which is part of the reason why we wanted to discuss this today. It's because the tokenization of Israel and like of this community essentially trying to create a false image as to why their presence is being threatened, if you will. And you always hear them, they always talk about, oh, like in Bethlehem it used to be 85% Christian, now it's only 10% Christian, that's because of the Muslims. And they always like paint out the Muslims to be this like big bad like wolf, if you will, like in the West Bank and in Gaza. Like, you never forget about how they talk about, oh, there used to be 5,000 Christians in Gaza, now there's only 1,000 Christians in Gaza. And it's like, again, it's
how many wars have you waged on Gaza in the past 17
exactly
years?
Like, exactly, it's this idea that they're trying to like paint a Christian to be different, a Palestinian Christian to be different from a Palestinian Muslim, when that has never existed within our society, right? Again,
I feel like it plays with the Westerners, right? Because in the West, where we are at currently, we have such a divide between the minorities that they play that against us.
Right.
So it's like, oh, you know, like you Americans, you know how there's also a divide between your minorities, the Black community, the Latino community, the Muslim, Arab, whatever community. And they try to push this narrative that it's the same exact thing in Palestine, right? Which obviously, right, secularism does exist everywhere. And secularism exists
you
everywhere. it was a bit
right.
hard on
it's
me.
It's not unique.
it's not unique to Palestinians, but for Palestinians, we do not have that big of a divide. We don't care if this person is a Christian or a Muslim. It's right. us against the occupation. And so to try and paint it as, you know, the Muslims are the ones driving everyone out, driving the Christians out. They're out against all of us. Mm-hmm. That's just simply not true. And to go from, you know, the 1930s, there was 80% Christians, and now there's less than 10%. Y'all are missing a very, very huge gap, which is the Nakba, where, you know, not just Palestinian Christians were exiled out of their Palestinian Muslims were as well. And it's just insanity to me, but I like, you know, they're good at what they do. They are
Right.
they're good at pushing propaganda that works with the mainstream Western media.
Right. And like Petra just said, like about this, the Nakba specifically being a main driving factor. And it happened in my village, sorry, in my city too, Nazareth, where essentially there it was majority Christian city, but after the Nakba, there was countless Muslims that sought refuge inside of Nazareth, like outskirt villages of Nazareth, went to Nazareth as the city and tried to, you know, seek refuge there. And that is what affected the overall, like, demographics, if you will. And same thing with Bethlehem. Like, after the Nakba, people, and after the Nexa as well, people went into these areas to seek refuge. And that, you know, did affect the demographics. But the main thing, and this is how we know that they just use them as a talking point, is that when you listen to Palestinian Christian sentiments on why they are leaving, or you know, the demographics or anything of the sort, you see one main thing, and this is something that has been supported by research. What is it called? The PCR,
The PCRPSR, PSR, I think.
yes, PC.
PCPSR, yeah.
Yes.
PCPSR, yep.
Them, okay. That's a very long name. They got to change that low key. Anyways, they did a lot of research on this, and it talks about the main driving factor being the occupation, right? Being like Israel, right? And it doesn't really talk about this Muslim divide or anything of the sort. So it's something that is clearly being used as a talking point, and it's also so disheartening that they're tokenizing this group that speaks very like very loudly about what their main concerns are, and it just so happens to be Israel. And I don't know, it's kind of interesting that they do all this. But the other thing that I also like, I think, is really important to highlight is the amount of settler violent attacks that happened inside the West Bank, specifically towards the Christian communities. And I'm reluctant to say specifically, because it's not only to the Christian communities, but it also happens to the Christian communities the same way it happens to the Muslim communities. It's like it's they don't view us differently because they're Christian or because we're Muslim. They, you know, attack a they have this supremacist ideology, and they attack us all equally because we're not Jewish. But we are focusing on the Christians today, and that's why I'll say specifically. Anyways, basically, if you look into it, and you look into like the attacks that happen, they're always being done by these extremist settler groups. And one of the main reasons why I wanted to talk about Palestinian Christians today is because of the Israeli threats on the Armenian quarter of Jerusalem. Now, if anyone knows anything about the Armenian quarter, it's been there since the 7th century, like thousands of years ago. And essentially, in 2020, like ever since Israel, ever since 1967, they have been facing like severe threats in their presence. They've stated that their presence feels threatened because of Israel's occupation. Now, the main thing that is happening inside of Jerusalem with the Armenian quarter, and it's not something new. It's happened before with other quarters, but essentially they are attempting to impose this new tax. It's called the Arnona tax, where basically it is applied to all citizens of Jerusalem. However, it's like being applied now to the religious institutions of Jerusalem, which normally that doesn't happen. And it's specifically targeting right now the Armenian Christian communities. So right now there's this whole thing where Israel is threatening to seize the land, seize the property, because of course they cannot pay these fees. It's like millions and millions of dollars. I think it was $150 million that they have to pay. They have to back pay in fees for taxes that they hadn't paid in the past, plus the taxes in the future. So it's like astronomical fees. They're being charged much higher rates, despite the fact that Israel doesn't even like tend to their communities, right? It doesn't really like they're in terms of the taxation, the Palestinian communities tend to be taxed at a much higher rate in Jerusalem, yet their communities don't really see the effects of these taxations. So it's like the same thing where they're going into, you know, Palestinian territory. And we can talk about the legality of this, specifically with East Jerusalem and how Israel doesn't have a right to even tax these communities, considering it is illegally occupied territory. But, you know, also the idea that Israel is threatening an ancient community that has been here for thousands of years. And suddenly, after, you know, being inside of Palestine since the 4th century and being inside Jerusalem specifically since the 7th century, now they're suddenly being threatened, and it's because of Israel. You know, and the patriarchate of Jerusalem specifically spoke out about this topic, and they essentially spoke about how, I'm going to quickly read it because, I mean, I can't really put it better myself. He says it like this. So he says this. The conduct of the Jerusalem municipality in this matter is also particularly inappropriate, as this aggressive process was initiated despite the establishment of a governmental committee in 2018 by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and chaired by then Minister Tzaki Hanegabi. The committee was tasked with finding a solution to the Arnona issue through negotiation and cooperation with the heads of the Christian communities in the Holy Land. This committee remains active and has held several productive meetings, yielding positive outcomes. Filing against the Armenian Patriarchate in the execution office, forcing it to pay this alleged Arnona debt, and even more so, proceeding with high foreclosure of its properties, could jeopardize the Armenian Patriarchate's long-standing mission in the Holy Land, which has been active since the 7th century. Furthermore, it could threaten the issued presence of, could threaten the continued presence of the Armenian community in the Holy Land, which dates back to the 4th century.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's just so insane to me that they have the audacity to kind of try to paint a narrative that the Christian, you know, presence depleting inside the Holy Land is because of Muslims, when clearly they're just not listening to the Palestinians themselves, because their plights are the same as any other Palestinian.
Yeah, and it shows, right, within the, specifically American, because I live in America, mm-hmm. I'm not sure how it is in Canada and other Western countries, but it shows that this connection between, you know, the Arab or the Palestinian Christians versus the American Christians. I believe it was in 2009, there's a Christian Broadcasting Network, which is an American Protestant, thank you guys,
that
Protestant organization. they came out and they claimed that, you know, Palestinian Christians are suffering systematic discrimination and persecution, specifically at the hands of Muslim population and the Palestinian government, aimed to like drive them out of their homeland. And in response, specifically since we were talking about Bethlehem, the Palestinians in there and in Beit Jala, they came out and said, no, this is not the reason for the mass exodus of the Christians. It's because of the agricultural land loss, the dispossession of Palestinian Christians from their homeland, the persecution of the Nakba, and the violence from the military occupation mm-hmm. that leads Palestinian Christians to be pushed out. And yeah, like I'm not sure, Lena, if you were mm-hmm. done.
No, for the most part, yeah. I mean, I think one thing, like, I want to highlight some Palestinian voices on this, and specifically mm-hmm. there's Munthar Isaac, which is a pastor at Bethlehem's Lutheran Church, is crazy, who talks about this specifically. And again, like, he really does highlight the idea that the reason why they're leaving doesn't have anything to do with the Muslims, and it's the Muslim families have the exact same fear that the Palestinian Christian families have. And he says this, there is the fear that this war might extend to areas in the West Bank, especially after the arming of the settlers and the announcement of the possible annexation of the West Bank. And I think, like, we all know the settler violence is, like, the number one cause of violence inside the West Bank specifically. But with the settler violence, it's this idea that they commit these attacks, they do all these things, and it's all basically state sanctioned, if you will. Like, it's all supported by the state because the state does nothing to really stop it. And all of this does aid in the leaving of the land by not only like the Christians but the Muslims as well, because it creates a fear, and it's this idea that they're literally arming them as well, that also does create a fear. So yeah, for the most part, yeah, I think that a lot of people need to try to at least speak out on what's happening in the Armenian quarter, because this is a very scary reality where we might see more Palestinian land being dispossessed, and land that literally shows the coexistence that has existed inside of Palestine for thousands of years, specifically with the Armenian community. So yeah, we definitely need to show our support and hopefully, you know, stop the foreclosure of these countless homes that are being taken right now and mm-hmm. religious institutions.
100%. Especially when you look at this was last year, there was like the executive committee of the World Council of Churches, right? And there was mm-hmm. a meeting in Bogota, Colombia, and like the board of Kairos Palestine, which is like a Christian Palestinian movement, sent them, and the title of this event was called Statement on Escalating Crisis in Gaza. And I'm gonna read to you guys what they, you know, what they said. They said, as Palestinians, as Christians, and as your partners, we would like to bring to your attention the following points. We believe that the title Escalating Crisis in Gaza is neither accurate nor adequate. The protracted crisis is a result of 8 months of Israel's incessant large-scale military aggression, which amounts to acts of genocide, prior to which Gaza has been strangled by a 17-year blockade that forced 2.3 million people to become aid-dependent and extremely vulnerable to famine and starvation. Not only is the term genocide absent from the title, it is marginalized in the body of the statement. Instead of being the essence of what the statement is condemning, it cannot be acceptable that crimes of such scale committed deliberately over 8 months be narrowed down to a quote-unquote crisis. It says that we deplore that the statement fails to mention Israel's seven, because like in the it talks about like, you know, it talks about quote-unquote humanitarian crisis, right, in this like little like pamphlet that they received. And they said, we deplore that the statement fails to mention Israel's seven decades settler colonial regime, apartheid, and prolonged occupation with total impunity as the root cause and the context that laid the grounds for the events of 7 October and the ensuing genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza and the grave escalation of Israel's atrocities in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. And it's really interesting. You have like Palestinian Christians who are like, you know what I mean? Like the minority of a minority who are mm-hmm. standing up and like defending, you know, the like, you know, what happened on the 7th of October. Mm-hmm. And you have like, you know, people, Muslims in the West who are just like too afraid and they're like, no, I'm not going to touch it because like, you know, my job or my influence or right. whatever the case is. And like you have them calling out an entire world Christian organization, right? And I think it's like beautiful. I think it's like, that's so, yeah, I think that it's extremely important that we continue to do this. And they say, we believe that the Christian community of believers has a special contribution to make. The call for an immediate ceasefire must be merely a first step to end this harrowing genocide, but not the ultimate objective. Ending the decades-long colonization of the Palestinian lands and the oppression against the Palestinian people.
Wow. Yeah.
What, you right? And it
mm-hmm. love them.
Literally.
this is just one thing that we saw of last year. And like, you guys know how we said, like, you know, they canceled Christmas. Right. This is not the first time they canceled, like, Christians in Palestine canceled, like, Christmas or Easter or all, like, or Mass or any of these events. It happened throughout the first Intifada, throughout the second Intifada. They canceled Christmas in 87, 88, and 89. Because of popular resistance. Right. And I think it's important to keep highlighting it and keep talking about it, right? Because, like, their suffering is our suffering. They are our people. So I think it's extremely important to talk about this. And I'm, like, really glad that we're, you know, doing it right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very happy you brought up the Kairos Palestine, because it's a very important Christian activism that actually started in 2009 when we saw, I mean, it's always been really bad. We saw like a large increase. Every single time we see something happening in Gaza, the 2008 war, it gets extremely worse for the people in the West Bank. So they started the Kairos Palestine in 2009 after they came out with the document called A Moment of Truth. Some of the writers or authors on this document were Michael Sabah, Atallah Hana, Mitri Raheb, and a few others. And they came out and said, you know, this is to declare that the Israeli occupation of Palestine is a sin, quote unquote, a sin against God and against humanity. And it's calling upon all churches and Christians all over the world to consider it and adopt it and call for the boycott of Israel. In section 7 of this document, it states the beginning of a system of economic sanctions and boycott to be applied against Israel. It also goes on to say the isolation of Israel will eventually cause pressure on Israel to abolish all of what it labels as the apartheid rules that discriminate against Palestinians who are non-Jews. And you see this within the Christian community. They're not just fighting for themselves, right? They're fighting for Palestinians as a whole. And I always go back to the disconnect of the Palestinian Christians living, you know, in the place where Jesus Christ was born, or Sayyidina Isa alayhi salam, and all of these Western Christians. So you hear the Palestinian Christians crying out for help, telling you, hey, you know, this is a sin against God, this is against humanity, boycott Israel. And then we have the evangelical Christians in the West or whatever saying, oh no, Israel is our only ally, we must protect it, God tells us to. And I feel like, again, it's never the same when you hear it from people directly on the ground. And then in 2009, when the Pope wanted to visit, the people, the Christian activists in the West Bank, literally wrote an open letter telling him, hey, can you please postpone your scheduled trip to quote-unquote Israel to show them that they must stop treating us this way, and it should end the apartheid, it should allow us to worship and to end the taxation on churches and the properties. These are our biggest concerns. So they, you know, we hear the outcries of Palestinian Christians, but we don't do anything about it here in the West. Is actually insane to me. Now about the settler violence. So the custodian of the Holy Land, I'm gonna butcher his name, so bear with me, Father Pierre Batista Pizzaballa. Sorry, y'all. I butchered it. I know I did. But he came out in 2012 and stated that the Jewish children treat Christians with contempt has made life increasingly intolerable for the majority of Christians. And he came out to talk about the pro-settler extremists on the Montessori and the town of Latron. They set fire to its doors, covered the walls with anti-Christian graffiti. They basically wrote death to Christians. The blasphemous quotes about Mary alayhi salam and Sayyidina Isa or Jesus alayhi salam. And they came out and stated, you know, this is a very big issue, and Israel has continuously failed to address the practice of the ultra-Orthodox Jewish schools and teaching their children to abuse people from you who aren't Jewish, right? And they said this includes children as young as 8. We've heard this, right? They spit out Christians on a daily basis. But yeah, it's very important to, you know, try to bridge the disconnection between the Palestinian Christians mm-hmm. and Christians internationally with how they are treated.
Right.
I did want to talk about if, you know, if we're still here, I wanted to talk about how the Israeli occupation and is forcing the minority of the minority of Palestinians, you know, to have tax cuts, to have educational cuts, and the pressure mm-hmm. it puts on the Palestinian Christians economic-wise. So yeah, in 2015, this is specifically talking about education. So number one, oh, sorry, I'm like jumping all over the place.
Everywhere, baby girl.
you know, it's the ADHD in me. But statistically, Christian Palestinians inside of the West Bank and Israel are actually one of the highest rates for educational attainment. Within everyone, so within Muslims, Druze, and Jewish people. So back in, I believe, 2010, maybe 2011, these stats are probably a bit different now, but the Palestinian Christians, a majority of them, which is 73%, all had college degrees or postgraduate education. I would like to say for the feminists out there, most of them were women, so W-women. Yeah, and they majored mostly in medicine and medical treatment. So to counteract this, Israel would go on to cut the budget for Palestinian Christian schools in Israel. And, you know, they cut it from 65%. They used to have 65% of the budget. They cut it down to 34% back in 2015. And this actually caused a huge strike in Christian schools. Palestinian Muslims also helped with this, and they accounted for at least 40% of these strikes and protests. But even after these strikes and protests, they didn't, you know, budge. They kept the budget the same. And Christians in occupied 1948 Palestine came out and said that they receive less than a third of what Jewish schools receive, which is less than $53 million. So not only are they treated differently in the West Bank, they're treated differently in Gaza. They're also treated differently inside of Israel. And we always hear this, right? No, we have 20% of our people are Palestinian Arabs or da-da-da-da. So we can't be racist and we don't have any apartheid. We don't have mm-hmm. any of this, but you guys do. You guys favor Jewish schools, you favor Jewish education, Jewish housing over anyone, and it plays a huge role for the Palestinian Christians.
Despite literally forcing them to pay higher, like, they force Palestinians taxes. To pay higher yeah. taxes, but we see nothing in their communities, right? And it's like, it's quite disgusting when you really think about it. But we all know what the purpose of it all is. The purpose is to aid in their, you know, immigration out of the land. They don't want exactly. non-Jewish people here, right? When they're imposing these disgustingly high taxes on communities that have existed here, ancient communities that have existed inside of Palestine, these exact homes have existed thousands of years ago. And, you know, they're essentially putting these egregious taxes on them that they know that they cannot afford, in order to dispossess them and then replace their communities with Jewish ones, right? That is the inherent goal. That's why you have so many settlers. By the way, like when I brought up the Armenian, the Armenian quarter of Jerusalem, do you know how many settler groups have like actively protested in the land dispossession of these people? Like. They make it a point to try to dispossess their land and repopulate it with the Jewish population. And yep. That is the main goal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean the Palestinian Christian. I mean, obviously Palestinians as a whole have been yelling mm-hmm. this out for years and years, but the Palestinian Christians have not only written letters to the Pope, they've talked about it to other churches. They created a whole advocacy groups specifically surrounding churches to try mm-hmm. and get their voices out there, but the disconnect is still there. I know in 2007, we had a congressman here in America, Henry Hyde, who wrote a letter to George W. Bush, and he stated that the Christian community is being crushed in the middle of the bitter Israeli-Palestinian quote unquote conflict, and that the expanding of Jewish settlements in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, were damaging the already dwindling Christian community. So, we do have some people who hear it, but obviously it's falling on deaf ears because it's still happening. We have multiple NGOs who come out and state, the holy places, the preventing of repairs on said holy places, the attacks, the physical attacks on religious leaders and their villages is continuously happening, but again, it's falling on deaf ears. The last thing I wanted to talk about before Habuba continues, I wanted to talk about the economy, the economical, sorry. Like reading three things at one.
You're
The
so
economical,
funny, bro.
sorry, y'all. The economical struggle that the Christian Palestinians face. And I wanted to specifically pinpoint it to what we would all think would bring the most money to Palestinian Christians, but it doesn't. And it's tourism. So we
For
all know.
those American, it's tourism for the Americans who don't know what ESL is, but keep going because you said it
Wait, what?
correctly. You said it
Oh, wait.
correctly, but there's
How did the
like
Americans say
tourism.
it?
No, we like there's it's like a different dialect. You know how like the Pope the pop and soda thing? It's like that. But there's either tourism or tourism. But yeah, keep going.
Okay.
Sorry.
So,
That was like an 80. That was an autism thing, my bad.
it's okay. You do it all you want. It's fine. But yeah, so number one. I hate how I say number one all the time. I'm gonna pause because I do. I say like number one and then go on, and it's like,
Say like
okay, there's no
okay,
number
just
two.
say first. Yeah, it's just be like I want
First.
to talk, like let's talk about that's it.
Yeah. So, okay, back. First, I wanted to talk about the profit and how it's largely controlled by external factors or external interests, and it doesn't go back to the Palestinian Christian population. So, different countries, when we say, like Thailand or all of these other countries, they rely on tourism, and this is what keeps their economy afloat. You would think the same, right, for Palestinians, specifically Palestinian Christians, because we see the pilgrimages. We see, pa Christians all over the world wanting to go to the Church of Nativity, to the Holy Land, to the holy areas. Unfortunately, though, despite the importance of all of these religious tourism, and specifically Bethlehem, much of it is dominated by foreign-owned companies and international agencies. So many of the Palestinian Christian-owned businesses, like hotels, restaurants, gift shops, they struggle to compete with the larger international companies that control the majority of these tourism infrastructure. And that it goes hand in hand with it limiting the economic benefits that remain within the local community. So local Palestinian Christian families, they find themselves, at quote unquote mercy of the external forces rather than relying on themselves. And with economy tanking, this pushes Palestinians to emigrate and find better opportunities somewhere else. Also, just the unpredictability of, the pilgrimage and traffic, especially when we do have conflicts going on in the Holy Land. So the seasonal or peak visits would be during Christmas and Easter. However, visitors outside of these periods can be very, very sparse, and it leads to economic or income instability for the Christian business owners who, again, rely on these traffic year-round pilgrimages. And with the occupation, we have to remember everything that all any money that goes into the occupied territories, the occupation takes a portion. All the taxes goes back to them. So we're not putting money back into the Palestinian Christian communities, and it does harm them, and it will push them to eventually go and find better opportunities outside. Last point I wanted to make is Going back to what Lena was saying and how the Zionists or the Israelis try to, push this narrative that it's other Muslim Palestinians that are pushing Palestinian Christians out. Well, the poll that we were talking about earlier, the public opinions poll, the PSR, PSPSR, they came out, and when they told the Palestinian Christians who wanted to immigrate, they specifically stated they wanted to immigrate to areas that had a large population of other Palestinians, and they did not specify if they were Muslim or Christian. So, yeah, I wanted to point that out. Even when they do immigrate or they are forced to be in exile, they go and find other Palestinians so they can continue sharing that culture and continue having their culture be alive.
You bro, yeah. You literally no notes. You like a
Eight
whole
down.
literally.
Ate that. Oh my God, I gotta bring that back. Wait, what was that the thing that I used to always say? I can't remember.
You devoured.
Devoured. Freaking ate down, honey. Okay.
Thank you, Pookies.
No, thank you, Cookie.
I'm gonna like talk about like specific like key figures like I did earlier, but like this is more focused towards like my favorite like facet of Palestinian resistance, which is armed resistance. There'll be armed resistance, but like we can talk about how like I already talked a little bit earlier, but like Najib Nasser, who was like the editor of Al Karamil, and he was like the first to sound the alarm of Zionist land acquisition and economic like implications, and because of this, like there were Christian Palestinian labor unions that, in like Haifa and Yaffa, who organized boycotts of Zionist goods and labor strikes against British favoritism towards like the Zionist settlers, and then there's like the Archbishop, the late Archbishop Hilarion Capucci, which is a Melkite Greek Catholic from Jerusalem. He smuggled weapons to the Palestinian resistance. In his official Vatican, like a Vatican diplomatic vehicle in the 70s, which is so freaking cool. So he didn't just, it wasn't a one-time operation. He like systematically coordinated with Fatah and the PLO during the 1970s to do so. They arrested him in 74, but the Vatican quite literally like pressured Israel to like release him, and he was exiled. But specifically, like he continued to advocate for armed resistance and even supported Hezbollah's fight against Israel in Lebanon. And this was ar the late Archbishop,
Okay, purr.
literally lit the Archbishop
Okay.
Hilarion Capucci. And so, then there was, we already know about like George Habash, and he, all the attacks that he carried out, the Dawson Field hijackings, the Israeli embassies and the Zionist officials worldwide that he partook or organized. Yeah, and so we have like so for example we have like Wadi Haddad. I talked about him a little bit ago, but he did the Air France hijacking in 76, which led to the Entebbe raid. If you remember, the Bibi's brother got yeeted in that.
I do
All right.
recall.
He also like assassinated an Israeli businessman in Belgium. He also did like global arms trafficking networks linking with the PFLP. Is like he also links the PFLP with like the Japanese Red Army, German Red Army, and Latin America guerrilla movements, which is so interesting. And in 1978, is the Mossad assassinated him using poison chocolate, and he was one of like Israel's earliest like targeted killings. And this is Wadi Haddad. And then you have Issam Sartawi, who is he was a Palestinian Orthodox Christian and a former medical doctor who was a key militant in Fatah in the 60s. He was trained in guerrilla warfare in Algeria and conducted and like he conducted Fedayeen operations inside Israel proper. He then was assassinated, in 83 in Portugal. By Mossad, or like some people believe it was like a PLO dispute, but probably most likely Mossad. And then like during the first, we talked briefly about this as well, but like the Beit Sahoud, like the Christian guerrillas there in the first and second intifadas, there were like several Christian fighters who joined militant brigades that attacked Israeli checkpoints and military vehicles, and they sabotage operations against illegal settlements. And there's also some like Beit Sahoud fighters that operated under Al-Aqsa Martyrs brigades, despite like Fatah being there, right, in like the you know, being a prominent force within the first intifada. And then there was the Bet Jala sniper cells, which Bet Jala was a majority Christian town, and it became infamous for its sniper attacks on the illegal Israeli settlement of Gilo or Gilo. So Palestinian Christian resistance fighters positioned themselves in Bet Jala's higher elevations and sniped at Israeli soldiers and settlers in the Gilo settlement and engaged in direct urban warfare with the Israeli army in Bet Lahem. And so then there is like Michel Neba or Naba, who was a Palestinian Christian, was a key military strategist for the DFLP. And he trained Palestinian fighters in Lebanon. There's Ilyas Kurzum, which is the Palestinian Christian martyr. He was killed. He was the one, Allah yarhamu. He was the one that was wearing, I believe, the Santa outfit. The one photo from the first intifada that you guys were there with. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was a Greek Orthodox fighter. He was in the second intifada, but yeah, he was involved in Fatah's armed resistance operations in Ramallah and was posthumously honored as a martyr by the PLO. And so specifically we have like there's like even like back to the Great Palestinian Revolt, right, in the 30s, we have like Fawzi al-Kawuji, who was an Orthodox Christian who commanded Arab guerrilla units against the British and Zionist militias. Bassam Abu Sharif, who was the senior strategist of the PFLP, he hijacked like multiple aircrafts. He did the Lod airport attack, and he, in 1972, Mossad sent him a book bomb. He survived, but he lost partial sight in his fingers. And then we have like, this is really interesting, but like Konstantin Zurek, because we hear so much misinformation. Mm-hmm. Konstantin Zurek, but he was like the Greek Orthodox Palestinian from Syria who coined the term Nakba, right, in 1948. And he laid the ideological foundation for armed Palestinian resistance. And he advocated for armed struggle as the only means for liberation. He influenced groups like the PFLP and the DFLP with his like revolutionary anti-colonial thought. And he encouraged Palestinian factions to align with global anti-imperialist movements. So I think it's important just like really briefly to talk about like Konstantin Zurek, right? People always use him like, oh, look at in his book, he always criticizes the Arab countries or whatever the freaking stupid argument is. What does he say? What do they say?
Oh yeah, they say that.
What's the argument that he criticizes
them for not leaving or for leaving? For telling them to leave or whatever the hell, which is not true.
But like, even if like, God forbid, we have like criticism of our like, you know, like this is how we grow and like,
right?
Like he criticized the Arab countries for one, like not doing anything during the like Arab-Israeli war. One,
yeah. His argument was that there needed to be more armed resistance.
Yes, like, that literally, and so I feel like it's so important because he's such a name that like he's like if you've looked, he laid the groundwork for like Edward Said, for like Ghassan Kanafani, like these Palestinian intellectuals and writers and academics, like he literally laid the groundwork for this thought. He was right. Like as important to Palestinian literature as Edward Said is, and he analyzed why the Arabs lost in 1948 and how colonialism had systematically prepared for them to lose, right? And he said that like we would need a radically different approach, one that was scientific, militarized, and ideologically coherent. He criticized Arab regimes for being weak, corrupt, and disorganized, which mm-hmm. we still to this day argue we the hold same
opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he was a harsh critic of Arab leaders, and specifically, but not the Palestinian cause.
Yep.
Right. And the meaning of the Nakba, he condemned the Arab leaders for their military and political failures. But his criticism was a push for stronger resistance strategies, and it was not to undermine Palestinian liberation. And he was the founders of modern Arab nationalism. So I think it's like important to like to kind of just like do that. But I can talk more about like a little bit more about like the about like some a little bit tiny bit There's like a few more names like we can list, right? So there's like Fuad Nassar, who was a Christian Marxist revolutionary and one of the first Palestinian communities to advocate for armed resistance. He led a Palestinian guerrilla battalion and against Zionist militias in the Galilee and the West Bank. He became a key figure in the Palestinian Communist Party and the Arab Nationalist Movement. He directly influenced George Habash and Wadi Haddad. There's Osama Halabi, who was a Palestinian Christian from Bethlehem. He was a commander, right, during the Second Intifada. Isam al-Kasrawi, right, who... Palestinian Christian from Haifa, who joined the PLO's armed wing and fought alongside, and he later fought alongside Hizb in Lebanon. And he was killed, Allah yarhamah, during the 1982 invasion of Lebanon. And there's a couple things, so much more. And then there's at least two non-Christian militants from Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, and it's Chris Bundock and Daniel Saba. Daniel Saba George, both from Bethlehem. Bundock was imprisoned by Israel for shooting at Israeli motorists during the Second Intifada, and at the time was described as the only Christian in the entire Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades. And George, he was later released in 2011 as part of the exchange deal for the release of like the soldier, the Gilad Shalit, I think. Mm-hmm. And then Abu Hamama, who was Daniel Saba George, was a senior Tanzim operative who was killed by Israel in 2006. And one quote from Kairos about resistance I'm going to end at least my spiel on, right?
We love your spiel.
I love you.
I love you. No, thank you this time.
Thank you.
Can you guys tell when I'm nervous? Oh my god.
No, okay. You're not. You're killing it. Okay. So I'm going to end it with this. And it says, the aggression against the Palestinian people, which is the Israeli occupation, is an evil that must be resisted. And this is straight from the babe's mouth, straight from Palestinian Christians, the Kairos group that is composed of Palestinian Christians who advocate continuously for a free Palestine. And I'll say it one more time, and it's the aggression. This is who they are. They are the aggression against the Palestinian people, which is the Israeli occupation. And it's an evil that must be resisted.
They ate with that.
Absolutely.
I love that. And we can't forget, you know, the infamous picture of the two masked Hamas security guards protecting the church in Gaza, where when the Catholic priest was meeting with the Palestinians, Christians inside of Gaza back in 2006. The propaganda of Palestinian Christians hating the Palestinian Muslims and vice versa, it just does not exist. And the reason why they are being exiled from the Holy Land is the same reason Palestinian Muslims are being exiled. And it's the occupation, the oppression that they are facing, which pushes them. And this is exactly like what Lina and what Hiba, what we've been saying. This is exactly what the occupation wants. They want to try and make the lives of Palestinians, whether they are Christian or Muslim, as bad as they can so they can try to immigrate. And like 90% of the time, they don't even allow them to do so.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't even really touch up on like the absentee landlord laws that Israel is still, you know, implementing in the West Bank today. And in Jerusalem specifically, but like that's also one of the main ways that they dispossess Palestinian land. And it all goes in with the end goal. Get rid of the non-Jews, get rid of like the Palestinians, because that's what we are at the end of the day. There's no difference between a Palestinian Muslim and a Palestinian Christian. At the end of the day, the occupation views us the exact same. Yeah. And it's also kind of funny because we saw Israel try to do it with Hamas and the Muslims, and saying like, oh, it's not us who are killing them, it's Hamas, it's the Muslims. And it's like, you know, they always try to pull something out from under their sleeve. And it's
every accusation is a confession.
Exactly. If you think hard enough, you'll see why it doesn't add up. And if you just do yourself a favor and listen to Palestinian voices, you know, You'd get the direct answer. You don't need to listen to Israel on who's oppressing us, because it's them. They're the ones who are oppressing us.
Yeah. I mean, Palestine, like we've said, Palestinian Christians wrote many, many, many letters to presidents, to popes, to anyone to try and get them to understand.
Anyone who will listen.
That, like, hey, yeah, like, hey, help us. We're being exiled out of our land because of said occupation. But yeah, I mean, I think this was a very important episode to have, especially with the Armenian Armenian, I don't know why I want to say headquarters so bad.
That works. Armenian headquarters in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
The Armenian patriarchate. Oh my God. Patriarchate.
Listen, it's almost 1 a.m. here. So we're, you know.
Patriarchate.
I think it's very important that we put, you know, we explain this to people and have people understand that, you know, the Armenian Christians truly need help right now, and they are asking for our help. So go do the protest, do whatever you can, or whatever, speak out about it, you know, share this podcast with someone who doesn't know, and let them understand that, hey, this is actively happening to Palestinian Christians, and maybe we should stop it.
Fairly recent, February. This is all as of February. This isn't even a month ago. So,
And I bet the viewers won't share this podcast with someone. Like, I bet you guys won't.
Like, I bet you guys won't share it.
Prove her wrong.
I bet you won't. Prove us wrong.
I bet y'all won't.
Send it to that Christian neighbor of yours.
Send it to your mom. Like, send it to your mom. Send it to your freaking neighbor. I don't care. Send it to anybody.
Yeah. So you guys, like, yeah. We're putting a lot of hours and time and, you know, money into this. So hopefully to educate y'all. So and to spread the word about our people. So, yeah, you guys should share, subscribe. I don't know. It's not subscribing. What it is, it's not YouTube.
Share, comment down below. Is there anywhere to comment down?
No, I don't think so. But there is a subscription.
Okay.
I didn't know.
Comment for us, Spotify. Please.
But there is a subscription thing. I know it is for, like, Apple. If you subscribe to the podcast, it does push it more to anyone, like, searching Palestine or whatever. So, yeah, make sure you are subscribed, whether you're I don't know if Spotify has it. I do know Apple has it. So subscribe, you know, push this out, and let's actually promote this so we can continue, you know, having our little
we're not asking, we're telling. So
we are telling you.
God is watching. I'm gonna tell on you if you guys don't do it.
Yep.
It's Ramadan. So y'all better.
Yep.
No.
I'm gonna tell. And Lent. Double whammy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks, y'all.
Petra,
take it away.
Yeah, so we have reached the end of the episode, which means it's time for Humanize Gaza. So Humanize Gaza is a thing we created when we continued listening to people, only saying women and children. And, you know, it kind of pissed us off to only hear this and have people forget that Palestinian men are human as well, and their stories deserve to be told. And we want to commemorate
the fighters and the family men.
Yeah, the fighters and the family men. Like, again, Hiba always says this, but, like, it's true. I hate defending men, but Palestinian men are the ones out and about trying to find food, digging through the rubble, finding the dead bodies of their family members, and they should be commemorated. And this is exactly what this is for. So we will be commemorating, we will try to commemorate every single martyr that we can find, not just in Palestine, whether it's the West Bank or Gaza, but also in Lebanon, who have the Lebanese martyrs who have been killed because of our cause. They will not be forgotten. And they're not just numbers.
Our cause is your cause. It's the same cause, BBG.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep. I 100% agree. If you would like, you can find more martyr stories if you head to Quora. And we are actually working on a newsletter where it'll automatically send it to your email, and you can read, you know, a martyr story every day. Today, since we are talking about Christians, we will talk about a Christian martyr. His name is Sleiman Tarazi, or Abu Jamal. He was 35 years old when he was martyred. and his murder date was October 19th of 2023. Leyman was a dentist, he was married, and he was a beloved father of two. Unfortunately, Sleiman lost his mother at an early age, and he was determined to become a very successful person for her and to be a big brother to his siblings. He always said he wanted to achieve his goal, and he did. He actually became one of the most successful dentists in the region and obviously an ideal husband and father. Everyone loved him. His whole community loved him. His kids absolutely adored him. And yeah, so during the carpet bombing by the Zionist entity, Sleiman tried to shield his children and he protected them for more than 16 hours. When family members and neighbors went to search for them, they managed to pull him from under the rubble. And being the father he is, he protected his son from the bombardment. Both of his children. So after 16 hours, he was literally shielding them. Both of his sons were found alive because of him using his body as a human shield to try and protect them. Yeah, Allah. Broke my heart when I read it. But yeah, both the sons were found alive. Unfortunately, he was not. People came out and said, you know, throughout all of this, throughout the genocide of Gaza, he, you know, alhamdulillah, he didn't see all of it. But throughout what he lived through, they came out and said he volunteered every single waking moment inside of the church for the refugees, and he tried to help them as well. He was martyred, and his wife was injured. Their sons, Jamil and Jad, were also injured, but they were found alive, alhamdulillah, in the pro-furious church, Orthodox Church. Mm-hmm. They were a beautiful family, Allah yirhamo. Inshallah, his wife and his kids are still alive and are able to, you know, showcase their dad and to continue the images of their dad. So Allah yirhamo, and I, you know, this isn't just one story. We saw what happened to the minority Christian people inside of Gaza, and they are becoming extinct. So we need to continue trying to aim for the justice of Gaza and the justice for all Palestinian liberation.
Ya Rab. That is like the most heartbreaking. It made me think of Muhammad al-Dara, like when you brought up immediately, like, you know, it's crazy that they labeled us as people who hide behind our kids, but you know,
we literally shield our kids.
We shield our kids, and they use our kids as shields, which is crazy. But Allah yarhamhum, ya Rab.
Allah yarhamhum, and I hope his kids are safe and, you know, are okay with everything going on.
Ameen. Allah yatim al-sabr. I don't know. I don't even know what else to say, because that is very heartbreaking. Thank you. Thank you, Petra, for highlighting that story.
Of course. Thank you, everyone, for listening to us yap about Palestinian Christians. Shout out to all of our Palestinian Christians. I know Ronnie is going to freaking kill me if I don't, mention his name.
Him. Oh my goodness.
So, Ronnie. Shout out to Ronnie, Glitchy, Augie, and Adam, all of our Palestinian Christians out there.
Our besties on TikTok.
Our besties. Love you guys. So shout out to you guys. And inshallah, we will see a liberated Palestine. And we can, you know, live like how we used to live.
Ameen, ya Rab. That was so beautiful, by the way. I love that.
Thank you.
Like, I'm tired of this life, Lena. Like, can I just be in Palestine?
No, literally.
Tending to, like, my olives and my, like, literally. My oranges. My oranges.
Every time I think about the fact that my grandparents used to own a freaking orange, like, freaking farm,
guys,
like,
when
I just cry.
When Palestine is freed, I'm going to peel oranges for you guys.
Oh my God.
That's, like, the love language needed. That is, and I'm from Yafa, so you know.
Literally. Guys, fun fact, me and Petra, my mom and Petra's family are from the same village in Yafa, which is like pretty unique because it wasn't that big of a village.
It wasn't. It was very tiny, and it was one of the very first villages that got massacred.
Yeah.
Oh, But yeah, so thank you, everyone. Just, you know, during the holy month of Ramadan and for Lent, you know, continue praying for Palestinians, both in the West Bank and Gaza. Continue praying for the Lebanese, especially South Lebanon. They are still going through it. Continue speaking about Palestine. Just because there was a ceasefire, I know it's no longer, you know, active, doesn't mean our plight has ended. Our, you know, our goal is a full liberation of Palestine. So continue speaking about it, continue commemorating the martyrs, and continue, you know, gaining knowledge about stuff that you don't, you haven't researched into, so that way you are able to speak. And if you are able to, don't forget Mahmoud Al-Khalili. Very, very important topic. So, you know,
Definitely. Yeah. Please sign all the petitions that are out there, because
if you can get out on the streets and protest, get your ass moving, y'all.
Get out there, y'all.
Don't forget to wear a mask, because I was reading, and again, I know like conspiracy theories. Mahmoud didn't have like the mask on, and they said this was maybe how they identified him and went and took him. So wear your masks if you do go to protest. Continue fighting for, you know, justice. We're living in America, yet we can't even protest. Right. They're stripping us from our constitutional rights, and it's not right at all. So let's continue pushing. We're not done. We're never going to be done until Palestine is fully free and fully liberated. So thank you, guys, and thank you, Lina and Habuba.
Thank you, Petra. Thank you, Petula.